Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and together this hour, we're going to come to grips with what happened this week. With my guests, Seattle City Council member Lorena Gonzalez, Washington State Republican strategist Randy Pepl, Seattle writer, co-founder of Seattleish, Hannah Brooks Olson. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Let's start off with the fact that this week, President Trump signed this executive order to strip away federal grant money from sanctuary cities. Seattle is one, self-declared. These are cities that basically they don't cooperate with federal immigration authorities. We can talk more about that. But this week, Miami responded by dropping its sanctuary city policy. Seattle did no such thing.
Today, January 25th, 2017, is the darkest day in immigration history in America since the internment of the Japanese Americans during the Second World War. Mr. President, I have a message for you. Seattle has been here before. We've experienced this dark history before, and we have no intention of going back there again.
That, of course, is Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. Let's start with City Council Member Lorena Gonzalez. There's not a legal definition of sanctuary cities. What does it mean in Seattle, basically?
Well, I think you mentioned it at the top of the hour, but it essentially means that we as a city refuse to do the job of the federal government. And the job of the federal government is to enforce federal immigration laws. Those are civil violations under federal immigration laws. It is our police departments to keep our community safe from violation of criminal laws. And we don't see it as our job or our role or our responsibility to do the federal government's job. And we're going to continue to refuse to do that. And that's not just a functional aspect position. It's also a values position, is that we believe that public safety is maximized and that livability in our community is maximized when we don't target immigrants, refugees, and Muslims by virtue of turning our police officers into an extension of the Department of Homeland Security, and we're just simply not going to do it.
How does public safety in Seattle benefit when the city doesn't cooperate in that way with the feds?
Well, we heard from Chief O'Toole, our Seattle Police Department chief, on Tuesday, and we hear from the major cities' chief of police associations that have repeatedly said that immigrants and refugees, whether documented or not, are victims of crime just like anybody else. And you are going to hamper yourself, and they can also be witnesses to crimes just like anybody else. Police departments and officers need to be able to have a way to communicate with and to be able to build trust with those communities to be able to effectively do their job. So the fact that President Trump is selling to the American people this executive order as though it's somehow a promise of public safety for Americans is just flat out wrong and not supported by any evidence.
Washington State Republican strategist Randy Pepl, what's your take? Do you oppose Seattle remaining a sanctuary city? Yeah. And by the way, it's Marysville, Kent, Puyallup. There are others.
I oppose cities deciding that they get to decide which federal laws they like and they don't like. If they don't like federal law, they should ask their representatives in Congress to change it.
But doesn't the city have the leeway?
And we have been asking the federal government to change it. There have been calls by city governments and by activists and even by some Republicans on the federal, state, county, city level demanding for comprehensive immigration reform of our broken immigration laws that do nothing other than to separate families. And the reality
is— And yet when you had a Democrat president, you couldn't get that through.
And the reality is that those reforms have not occurred.
I want to make it clear. Can I make it clear for the listener?
Those laws have been reformed, and that is why that's why our population of undocumented immigrants keeps growing in this country, is because we have not provided them a legal pathway to be able to adjust their status.
I want to bring the listener along here. Okay, that's what we're trying to do. They may be wondering, wait a minute, is Seattle breaking some kind of— Seattle doesn't have the federal law it wishes it had, and so it's somehow out of compliance or breaking the law? Or is this just something that the city of Seattle gets to decide whether they want to go further, bend over backwards and cooperate or not?
Well, just as the city of Seattle can decide whether they want to cooperate with immigration authorities, the federal government can decide whether or not it's going to provide money to the city of Seattle.
Right. And so and the mayor accepted the that, Seattle, right, and said,
if the city of Seattle doesn't want that money, if they are so flush with money that they want to turn that away, go right ahead. This is a nice opportunity for Ed Murray while he's running for re-election as mayor to grandstand, and it plays well with his base here, not unlike the executive order playing well with President Trump's base also.
Okay. Let me bring Hannah into this. Hannah, you're a Seattle resident?
Yeah? I am.
Are you okay with paying more? This was a possibility, the mayor said, possibly paying more local taxes to make up for federal funding we could lose.
Oh, certainly. But I think it also deserves note that the Attorney General of the state of Washington also came out with a similar statement this month. And so as a state, and the governor has done the same, right, saying that, yes, like Washington state will continue to be a safe place and that we will not bend over backwards to, you know, enforce that federal law. So I think it's always interesting to me to hear Republicans making the argument that they should comply with federal law when I was made to believe that Republicans believe in states' rights. And so to me, this seems like a states' rights issue. And actually, Washington state is doing exactly what we are promised under this idea of smaller government, which is we're making the decision for ourselves.
Republican, is the federal government bigfooting a local jurisdiction? Who knows better?
The federal government is responsible for national security. This is a national security issue.
Okay, but
not
also,
one for the federal, not one for the
it's
states
also
to
not
decide
a crime issue, though. It's untrue
that's what
that
you
it's
say. So no felons that should have been deported
it's not what
have
I
been.
Say. It's based have, on FBI crime data. FBI crime
none
data was
have
released.
Committed
this?
Any crimes?
FBI crime data was released this month that found that cities that are sanctuary cities and counties have lower instances of homicide and crime in general. And that's not just like...
And that's reflective of not their sanctuary city standpoint.
No, that's reflective of people being able to, as Lorena said, join in and be part of their community and report crimes when they see them and take part in investigations. Because when people are... And that is...
Making
is even
a causal connection is not one that I would suggest myself.
But you're making a causal connection when you
okay,
say...
I have to put
all immigrants.
My job is to pause there on facts that we're not going to agree on, and that's okay. One more question on sanctuary city, and then there's more I want to talk about here with the new president. Since there's no legal definition, Councilmember Gonzalez, why not drop the phrase? Bellevue police don't ask about people's immigration status, but they say they're an inclusive city. Tacoma says we're a welcoming city. Does Seattle have to make this stand, or does it not really work that way in the president's executive order?
Well, the president's executive order refers to sanctuary jurisdictions. You know, the personally, as somebody who came up in the immigrant rights movement and somebody who grew up in a Mexican immigrant household, I don't like the phrase sanctuary cities, and I don't use it.
Why
is
that?
You haven't heard me use it a single time on this broadcast. I think it's intended to be pejorative, and I think it's intended to feed into the Republicans' narrative that sanctuary means that we're going to protect bad people. And I don't think that it's true that you can brush a broad stroke when you talk about immigrants and refugees and say that they're all bad just because they don't have legal status to be in our nation. And so, you know, one of the things that I've been trying to do is talking about this through the lens of a welcoming city. We have always been a welcoming city here in Seattle. I think that's true to our values in the city of Seattle. I think it's true to our American values to be a welcoming city and a welcoming nation. And, you know, one of the things that I'll be doing on Monday, this Monday, January 30th at 2 p.m. in council chambers at City Hall, is I'll be introducing a resolution that reaffirms and extends our commitment and lays out some strategies around how we continue to be a welcoming city in light of and in spite of Trump's executive actions.
Randy, you said that you think President Trump is also grandstanding and playing to his base here. You don't think much of this flurry of executive orders is going to actually stick to the ground?
No. I mean, I think it's much ado about nothing, frankly. And it's not unique that when a new president comes into office that they issue a flurry of orders. Trump has done more than most, but there was a very interesting article in Politico today that kind of ranked the orders on what their immediate impact is and what their long-term impact is. And for the most part, these are not going to be impactful because legislation is required to achieve permanence. And the legislative process is much slower than the executive order process, thankfully. And so I think you're going to see the flurry of orders slow down at some point, and then we'll get down to legislating. But in the meantime, this lets the base know that Donald Trump wants to do what he campaigned on. And for those who opposed his candidacy, they're not going to like him.
How do you feel about Donald Trump?
I didn't vote for him. I don't think he's qualified to be president, and it's unfortunate that our nation selected him.
I just think it's disingenuous to say that these executive actions and orders are much to do about nothing. That is completely unfair to the thousands and millions of immigrants living in the shadows in our country and here who I have heard from directly expressing deep, deep fears about their future in this country. This includes children who were brought here without their knowledge when they were babies, who've gone through our education system, who know no other country, who are 4.0 students at the University of Washington, who are now at risk of being deported under this president.
But isn't Randy saying we just don't know yet? For example, that's the DACA program. We don't know.
We absolutely know.
Under these executive orders. That's what we're talking about.
These executive
Councilwoman
orders.
Councilwoman Gonzalez, is that
these
not what we're talking about?
Excuse me.
Is that the, not excuse, what we're talking
okay,
about?
Okay,
these
okay,
executive
okay.
orders, for example, just to highlight one of the impacts, it exempts, if you are a U.S. citizen or a legal permanent resident, you are still protected by the Federal Privacy Act. If you do not fall into either or two of those categories, you are no longer protected by the Privacy Act. You know what that means? That means that the hundreds of workers at Amazon who are here on visas, guess what? You just lost your privacy under this executive action. So to sit here and say that this doesn't have real consequences for real people today, the moment he signed it, is just absolutely false.
Tomorrow, you mentioned, Randy, that you didn't vote for President Trump. The state Republican Party tomorrow elects a new chair, and the winner is Susan Hutchison because she's the party chair now and she's the only one running, even though I thought that her fellow Washington state Republicans were mad at her for being so pro-Trump.
Well, I think that the partisans on both sides are always mad at their state party chair for something.
Uh-huh.
But the Republicans are less angry at the grassroots level with the leadership of the party than the Democrats are, who face a very spirited challenge in their election this week. And so she has managed to assuage any doubts among the rest of the members of the executive committee. And so while you never say you're running unopposed until nominations are closed, it appears that she'll win re-election. The fact is, it could be a relatively short term as she's under consideration for appointment by the administration, which would take her out of the position relatively soon.
Mm. What does it say about the Republican Party in Washington State? Because the public image has been that even the Republican Party, some of its leaders, Chris Vance, who ran for Senate and was the chair of the party, Rob McKenna, former attorney general, and you just a moment ago have backed away from President Trump. What is the Republican Party in Washington State?
Well, I think the Republican Party in Washington State is very happy to have control of the state Senate and be within a vote in the state house.
They don't have control right now, by the way. Senate is tied at present. I just want to say it.
And this is because the Republicans have lost a lawmaker to the Trump administration.
And one lawmaker passed away.
Right.
There was as an appointment.
He's already been replaced.
Yeah, he's been replaced by Dino Rossi.
Yeah, so Republicans control the state Senate, notwithstanding the current vacancy that'll be filled within a week.
By a Republican.
But the reality is the Republicans have had tremendous success over the last decade in closing the gap in the state legislature so that the grassroots are happy about that. And that's what's reflected at the state party level.
Hannah and Lorena, what grade do you give to the Washington State Democratic Party leadership?
Man, Washington Dems are in a spot right now. There's a lot of soul searching going on, and you see it from the top of the state party down to the county levels and in the LDs. You can just see, like, there's a lot of people trying to determine.
LD is legislative
district.
Legislative district,
sorry. People are trying to figure out what they want from leadership. You know, as Randy just said, like there's been this narrowing. And so there's a lot of looking at which swing Senate seats we can look at, and including a couple of the newly vacated ones. And so there's going to be a lot of decisions to be made for the Dems about how they want to lead the party and what kind of Democratic state Washington wants to be.
I mean, I would agree. I think that I believe that there are some folks within the Republican Party who are doing some soul searching to figure out how to, you know, sort of coalesce. And I think that the same soul searching is occurring within the Democratic Party. And I think it's a very important process. And, you know, I think the biggest struggle for Democrats, of which I am one, is to really figure out how to be more inclusive and how to figure out how to bridge conversations with people who feel like they are unable to connect with how the Democratic organization works. That doesn't mean that they're not connected with the values that Democrats represent, but it does mean that they're having a hard time figuring out how to plug into that organizing structure. And really, I think that the organizing structure for Democrats is what has to fundamentally change. If you've ever been to a legislative district meeting, you know what I mean. They're very hard to access. It's all about the Roberts Rules of Order. It's you know, about paying membership dues. Not to say that those can't be waived based on need, but it's very hard to come to that when you are a working person who, for example, doesn't speak any English but is a registered voter and wants to be democratically involved.
Before we leave President Trump for a moment, is this a fair criticism? This is the former Washington State Republican Party Chair Chris Vance.
Every American has to do their part, but when Democrats criticize Donald Trump, Republicans just tune it out. The key to our future now is Republicans. And I hope some of them are listening right now who know who Donald Trump is and what he's all about and what he's doing, but now are too afraid to say anything about it because they're putting party loyalty above country. People who 5, 6, 8 months ago said they'd never support Donald Trump now are on their knees, you know, pledging fealty because he's the Republican boss.
Randy, you're a Republican strategist. Is that fair to say Republicans are afraid and on their knees and putting party loyalty above country?
Well, I think that Chris could have probably clarified his remarks to say some Republicans, and I think that's probably true.
I think he was clear about which ones he was talking about, right?
But the fact is, not all Republicans supported Donald Trump, and they don't support his action. But at the flip side,
those are the ones
that
he's talking to.
Right, but the flip side of that is they don't necessarily support the Democrat response either. I mean, it's instructive that, you know, over the last 8 years, Republicans have been called obstructionists. Right now, the Democrats are called the resistance. There's a slight difference in terminology there for those who oppose what a president tries to do.
Yeah. Is that equivalent? Are Democrats now being obstructionist in the way that they accused conservatives of being under Obama?
I mean, I don't think anybody is I don't think you're obstructing anything when what you are pushing for is things like continued access to health care and reproductive care. I don't see that as being
obstructionist. So it depends on what your politics are, whether someone's being obstructionist or not?
I think it depends on whether or not you're trying to keep something away from somebody or not.
Okay, well, we can go all around about that. Let's talk in a moment. I want to talk about the Seattle Women's March and what it was about and what it's accomplished. A controversial speaker on the University of Washington campus and who's responsible for the violence that came out of that and more coming up on KUOW's Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review is on the air, and we're live tweeting, of course, at KUOW with City Council member Lorena Gonzalez, State Republican strategist Randy Pepple, and the co-founder of the Seattle-ish site, Hannah Brooks Olson. Over the weekend, the University of Washington's College Republicans invited a controversial speaker to campus. Milo Yiannopoulos is best known for insulting people on the website Breitbart. He got kicked off Twitter, and that's hard to do. He got kicked off for encouraging insults directed at the African-American actress Leslie Jones. And on the UW campus, he mocked the Seattle Women's March.
Just think about it. 50,000 hairy, overweight feminists wandering hopelessly lost around downtown Seattle like drunk Sasquatch convention attendees. Have you noticed, by the way, these armpit hair braiding West Coast fem squatchers? Spell women with an X. Have you seen that? WOMXN? The X is silent, a bit like their own ex-boyfriends. Silent because they ate them.
People protested his speech, mostly peacefully. They reportedly, though, also some of them threw bricks and paintballs at people lined up to see Yiannopoulos. One protester was shot by someone who was there in support of Yiannopoulos. Hannah, should the University of Washington just not even have allowed this man to speak?
Here's the trouble. And I've read several statements now from UW President Annemarie Cause, and you know, I've read all the statements from the College Republicans who brought him, and there's a lot of setting this up as you know, there are that everybody deserves free speech on both sides, right? That on both sides of this issue, everybody should be able to talk. However, I think that putting on equal footing people who are talking about like Republican ideologies and laws and a man who has not only incredibly lazy and tired jokes about women, but hurtful ones. A man who once wrote, quote, "I think birth control was a mistake and women are happier in the kitchen." A man who frequently espouses that, quote, "West is best," who is so unbelievably racist and misogynistic and Islamophobic and transphobic and sexist. And like,
should he not have been allowed to speak on the UW campus?
I don't believe that is equivalent. Like, I think it's a false equivalence to say that we allow free speech on both sides when one of them is demonstrably hate speech.
Well, it's a public institution and you're part of the public. Do you want the University of Washington hosting that talk at Kane Hall, whether you like it or not?
No, I don't, because I think there's a difference between things I disagree with and things that are actively hurtful and things that create an unsafe space on campus. Because free speech doesn't...
Milo Yiannopoulos would say that it's not actively hurtful to say obnoxious, tired jokes.
I think telling women
jokes
to kill themselves is actively hurtful, which is the thing he has done frequently. He has told women to kill themselves. I find that to be actively hurtful.
Okay, so he's not you know, disallowed from being on campus. Lorena Gonzalez?
You know, sir, as a Washington State taxpayer and as a woman and as a woman of color and as somebody who grew up in poverty in central Washington State, you know, he rings a lot of bells for me when he talks in terms of his level of offensiveness. And I'm also a trained lawyer, a trained constitutional law lawyer and civil rights lawyer. And I do think that when we look at the First Amendment, we should look at the First Amendment with the understanding and the context that there are restrictions. It's not an unfettered right to free speech. And I have serious questions about whether the University of Washington went through the rigor it should have in its First Amendment evaluation of this particular event. And even in the event of saying, hey, we did this, we believe that under the First Amendment, we have to allow this speech to occur.
Which is what the president said.
Which is what she said. Then they have a duty to provide safety with the understanding of the type of hateful rhetoric that is going to be espoused in the context of understanding that our political times are incredibly volatile right now, and people are feeling very emotional on both sides. On both sides, people are feeling very emotional, and you have to your tactical response in that environment has to be commensurate with that level of heat and passion that is coming from all sides. And
okay, so there are two things there. First of all, are you saying that Yiannopoulos' speech is the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater? It is speech that's too threatening to be allowed?
I think it's provocative. I don't know if I'd go as far as saying that it's like yelling.
Well, that's the classic legal example, right?
It is. It's not the only one. But I think that if you know that there is going to be an effect as a result of the speech that is being delivered, and you know what the contours and the depth and the significance and the weight of that speech is going to be, then I think you as an institution, as a public institution, have a responsibility to make sure that everybody's safe, not just the people who are delivering the speech, but also the people who are there to protest the speech.
That's just a common
public safety principle that I think, you know, perhaps the mark was not fully met.
Right. So that's part two. That's about campus police and the police response and public safety. Randy Pepl, do you disagree with any of that?
Well, I mean, I would certainly agree that Milo's an obnoxious person who says obnoxious things. What I disagree with is the traditional liberal definition of if we don't like it, we can say it's not allowed under the First Amendment. And you know what? It is allowed. You can vote with your feet. Don't go. As to the safety considerations, it seemed to be the protesters who were trying to shut down access to the speech that were the ones causing the problems.
I'm sorry. I have to ask a clarifying question really quickly. Do you think telling women to kill themselves is just obnoxious? That's how you would define that?
I would define it as obnoxious. I don't believe it, and so I don't listen to
it. Like if someone told, like,
kill
herself, that would just be obnoxious.
It is. It's obnoxious and stupid. So what?
It's not hurtful. It's not.
If you decide that the person that
like if someone was suffering with a mental illness, and then they heard that someone that their school was sponsoring a speaker on campus who tells people to kill themselves, that's obnoxious to you. That's not.
Yes, it's obnoxious to me.
Huh. Cool.
You know, I don't have any respect for him, so I don't put any value in what he says.
So looking forward, so the University of Washington will be faced with a question like this again and has in the past, right?
There's a protest on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
It's being organized by a series of UW students who are in favor of building the wall, where the poster for it encourages people to bring bricks to the rally. So I would like to know what the UW is doing about that.
Bringing bricks, meaning so if the university says, wait a minute, bringing bricks, that could lead to someone throwing a brick.
Yes.
That could hurt somebody.
Yes.
Are you suggesting the university doesn't allow that demonstration because of...
I'm curious about what they're going to do to, as Lorena said, make the university a physically safe place.
Are they going to keep them off Red Square, which is actually composed of bricks, which get dug up and used in these protests and were used in the 60s?
Okay, but
so you're not going to go to Red Square because it has bricks?
But encouraging people to bring something that they can use to throw at someone, you would feel okay again with like
again they're I wouldn't go to the rally. Doesn't appeal to me at all. But they're talking about building a wall. They can build it out of cardboard bricks if that's what they're so inclined to do.
I mean, perhaps these don't appeal to you because you're not the one who's being targeted by these
executive
actions. No, I just disagree with
the other federal actions.
No, I just disagree with it.
Well, this is a question, right? Is that and Milo Yiannopoulos talks about his one of his refrains is that these are just words. So
it's really
I think that's what we're getting at is
words when you're a white dude. It's super easy for things to just be words when you're not the one being denied health care, when you're not the one being denied reproductive access, when you're not the one getting deported, when you're not the one who's being barred from voting. Like that's
well, separate,
very easy.
Separate from whether you agree with him or not, he's gay and is one of many people who embraces the word faggot. And you heard him talk about lesbians. And, you know, so if it's about whether someone, the speaker, is in a protected class or is a vulnerable person, Milo Yiannopoulos would say otherwise.
He has written often about how absolutely much he loathes his own being gay. He doesn't like other gay men, and he'll talk about it frequently. He is someone who I think is so hateful both of himself and other people that I don't think he knows what it feels like to be afraid for your own personal safety because he just feels anger.
And I will say that there is a phenomenon of being from a historically oppressed community and opting to adopt the oppressor's language in order to self-preserve and in order to protect yourself and those who you love. I'm not saying that that's what he's doing, but I do think that it's important for us to remember that is a concept that does exist in reminding ourselves what you'd be willing to do and say in a moment of self-preservation is a pretty scary thought.
In case it's not obvious, I'll repeat the obvious that no one here is endorsing the views of Milo Yiannopoulos, and that's not what the discussion is about. But what the University of Washington, as you pointed out, Hannah, has a decision to make on Monday. I didn't know about that, whether to allow that speech to go on, and there'll be more speakers to come anytime somebody gets famous and gets a book deal, which he now has, by the way, from Simon & Schuster. Milo
does.
Roxane Gay pulled her book. Yep. I believe I'm going to be interviewing her, Roxane Gay, very soon about that. We're working on that. But that's the question that the University of Washington and any public institution faces. Let's talk about by the way, this is KOW's Week in Review, and you're listening to Randy Pepl and Hannah Brooks Olson and City Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez. And we're talking now about the Seattle Women's March, which Milo referenced. Biggest march in the history of Seattle. More than 100,000 people on the street, part of a worldwide event. First of all, let's just go around the table. Can you tell me in a sentence, Hannah, what the marchers want?
From what I saw where I was, the marchers want inclusive policies, specifically those which benefit women.
Mm-hmm. Inclusive policies that benefit women. Is that your take as well, Lorena, Councilmember?
I think so, and I think that the tool to begin accomplishing that and to set the framework for that happening is by showing that a large number of women and their allies across the nation want to see that happen. And so strength in numbers is a concept that is very familiar to us as Americans. And I think that the demonstration was an example of that. It'll be our challenge as a movement to figure out how to shift that into action. I believe that we're up to that challenge. I certainly am as a leader here in Seattle. And I'm looking forward to seeing those conversations continue to figure out how is it that we're going to shift that energy in that direction.
Randy, is that you accept that good nutshell as well, advocating for inclusive policies that benefit women?
It was liberals getting together to say they don't like Donald Trump and Republicans, which is not a new message. They tend not to.
Are you not hearing what two women just told you the Women's March was about?
Well, I think if you look at who was trying to push the march, I mean, I am on a lot of lists and get a lot of emails. So who was pushing it? It was the labor movement. It was the environmental movement. It was the social justice movement. It was the folks who are opposed to all things Republican. And so that's what they were pushing. And, I'll repeat what someone else said, which other analysts have noted. If they brought that same enthusiasm to some work in the first week of November, they would have been celebrating on Friday at the inauguration, not marching on Saturday.
And what do you conclude from that?
That they didn't have that enthusiasm for their candidate last November, and they lost.
They won the popular vote, if we're talking about it.
Right, but that isn't how it's decided.
Right.
No, it's decided by the electoral college.
And as Barack Obama himself said in 2009, elections have consequences, and that's what they're seeing now.
And also voter suppression has consequences. So in those electoral states that went red, where people were turned away because they didn't have IDs, there was also that. So let's also make sure
And the courts already looked at that and found no merit to it in the states you're talking about, Wisconsin
the courts
and Pennsylvania.
That are controlled by Republicans. That's exactly correct.
Republicans control everything.
I asked the question about what the march was about because I remember a few years ago the Occupy Wall Street marchers being, the march anyway, being criticized for being unfocused. So whether you agreed or disagreed, it was you've got to hone in on a clear, memorable message that people can act on. Hannah, do you feel that so far, it's just today, right? It's not even tomorrow yet. Do you feel that the Seattle Women's March did that or can do that?
I think one challenge in the sort of public perception of this Women's March is, and you heard Milo being oh so confused by the use of the letter X, which I will clarify. The fact is that not all women are, have the same genitalia. Not all women are built in similar way. There's a lot to what it means to be a woman, and that includes trans women. And so one thing that's going to be hard, I think, for public perception with the march is going to be understanding the intersectionality of it, that it's hard to boil everything down into one nut because you can say policies which benefit women, which I did. But what I mean by that is I mean immigration reform benefits women, labor laws benefit women, inclusive economics benefits women, family leave benefits women, healthcare benefits women, access to reproductive healthcare benefits women, right? So when we talk about laws that benefit women, it's not just like Planned Parenthood, although that's a good start, or just the ACA. It's also public education and college debt forgiveness and tax reform. There's so much in inclusive policy that helps women. And so that can be a little hard to focus on for people who have a very traditionally narrow view of feminism and of which policies, quote unquote, help women. If you ask people to be which policies are the most useful for women, they'll tell you birth control. And it's like, sure, yes, access to birth control, 100%. But also increasing the minimum wage and sick leave and, you know, retirement benefits and portable benefits. And like, there's all these other ways that we can help women. And so that's, I think, going to be the hardest thing for the public to understand when looking at what it means to have a women's march, because Randy's right. A ton of different organizations were behind it. There was the labor movement and there was, you know, the environmental movement. And that's because labor and the environmental movement all directly benefit women. And so if it looks like it's a lot of things under one big umbrella, it's because it is. But that's because it takes a lot to benefit half of our population.
And let's talk to perhaps a listener who marched on Saturday and maybe hasn't done something like that before. And who knows what's going to happen in the future? I talked about this to Anila Afzali. She's the head of MAPS Amen, the American Muslim Empowerment Network. She was one of the speakers there. And she said, remember, marching, great, but you haven't done the work. This is the beginning.
The way I described it was almost like we Muslims, I'm an American Muslim, and we recognize that we pray five times a day. And before our prayers, we do an ablution, a purification. And that purification has benefit in and of itself. But if you don't do the prayer after the purification, you've kind of missed the point. And that's essentially the way I see the march. The march was a step. It was a preparation. It was a launch pad for the actual work. It wasn't the work itself. I'm glad people showed up, including people who had not been active before. It was beautiful to see that. But people now have to take the next step and actually do the work.
So City Council Member Lorena Gonzalez, what do you think the work is?
Well,
next, what happens next?
I'm glad that we were able to, and that your listeners were able to hear Neela's voice. I actually know her from my law school days, and am good friends with her, and really believe in her leadership. But I think she's absolutely right. I think the work is, what are the inclusive policies that we are going to demand for, and how are we going to accomplish that in a federal government that is controlled by Republicans who believe that policies related to women's rights are better dictated by humans who don't have woman parts. And I think that's going to be a really, really significant challenge for us. And, you know, perhaps taking a cue from the Republican playbook, we're going to be relying on state rights and city rights in a way that we haven't done, had to do in the past, in order to protect the gains of the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement in this context. And so I think we've really got to coalesce around what will our national agenda be and how will we effectuate that agenda, not by relying on a Republican-led federal government, but in our states, in our counties, and in our cities.
Well, since you mentioned taking a page from the Republican playbook, Randy Peppel, set aside your opinion of the issues that the Seattle Women's Marchers were advocating. What's your I want you to turn coat for a moment and give those marchers your strategist. What's your strategic advice to them to be successful?
Well, they have to win elections, and they have to win elections in places that they haven't been winning recently, or at least in the last election. So they're going to have to focus their efforts in those swing districts, swing states that will matter in 2018 and 2020 as the next administration comes in.
Which might mean traveling outside of your district if you're in a safe Democratic district.
Yeah, I mean, spending time marching in Seattle doesn't really help your electoral prospects much. The city of Seattle hasn't elected somebody with an R after their name to a citywide office since, I believe, 1984 was the last time there was a Republican legislator represented in any part of the city of Seattle. So do you move the needle from going from 83% Democrat to 85% Democrat? That doesn't help you much. You're going to have to engage elsewhere. And frankly, there are people who came out to the Women's March, not just in Seattle, but in places across the country, who had not participated before and were not part of the kind of liberal machine that just is they're against all things Republican, and so this was their opportunity to enunciate on that. And it's how do they keep those folks engaged? Because if it's just the liberal crowd that will march against anything Republican, anything conservative, then that's not going to broaden their base. It's not going to help them win elections.
There you go, Seattle Women's Marchers. You just got free advice from a Republican strategist. You're welcome, Randy Pepl, Lorena Gonzalez, Hannah Brooks Olson. More coming up on KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for tweeting with us at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. It's the Week in Review. Seattle may get the first safe injection site in the United States. As we air this show, live in the noon hour anyway, King County and Seattle officials are expected to announce a pilot project for a place where people can use heroin under medical supervision. Right now, the only safe injection site in North America is in Vancouver, British Columbia. A Republican Washington State senator has introduced a bill to ban these sites. Councilmember Gonzalez, what's your vote and why?
Well, I, in addition to being a Seattle City Council member, I also sit on the Seattle King County Public Health Board. And last week, the board passed a resolution in favor of safe injection sites and of the overall recommendations from the Opioid Heroin Task Force, which was stacked full of medical professionals who understand these issues from a scientific perspective. You know, I am incredibly supportive of a public health harm reduction approach to the heroin epidemic in our country and in our city. West Coast are being hit particularly hard by heroin and opioid overdose right now. Just a few weeks ago, we had 4 people die in 1 week as a result of overdose. These were not deaths that occurred in homes. It was deaths that occurred in public spaces, in plain view, in plain sight. The Vancouver model shows that there is a real public health benefit to bringing these people inside and having supervised injections. They've had 0 deaths as a result of overdose since beginning their program. So for me, this is about not ignoring the fact that we need to figure out how to get upstream to prevent people from becoming chemically dependent in the first place. That's absolutely part of our challenge and part of the work. It's also recognizing that there are people who are way beyond that path and are dying right now because they cannot break their chemical dependency. And I think we have a public health responsibility to acknowledge and meet those people where they're at. And this is a evidence-based strategy, and I'm excited to be able to support it from that perspective.
Randy, as we try to prevent addiction and overdoses, we try to keep people from dying. That's the idea. What do you think?
Well, I think it's sad testimony on the impact of the policies that have been pushed in Seattle and in King County over the last few decades addressing homelessness and substance abuse, that basically they're giving up and saying we're going to permit illegal activity, that their policies have been so disastrous.
Council members saying you're doing two things at once, that trying to prevent addiction and overdose and at the same time helping people who are addicted keep from dying and sharing diseases with needles, et cetera.
As I said, the fact that they've been pursuing these policies for the last decade to end homelessness now, I believe was the slogan a decade ago, and they've made the problem worse. It's the policies aren't working. And
Which policies? Now they're
just basically giving up and saying we're going to permit public illegal activity.
Yeah, but which policies actually aren't working? Like, name a homeless policy that leads to opioid addiction. I'm curious what that policy is that you're thinking of, because I can't think of it.
You can't.
What is it?
You can't think of a single policy that the city
pursued. She asked you the question.
No, I know, and I'm asking a question back. I'm just suggesting to you.
Okay, so Randy can't name a policy,
okay.
So that's
you're,
fine.
You're wrong.
So separate for a moment from homelessness, are you saying if you had a vote, you would not allow safe consumption sites in Seattle and King County because it encourages illegal activity? Is
correct.
That okay?
Here's the facts. People are using heroin, whether you encourage them to or not. Nobody is encouraging anybody to use heroin, period. What we are encouraging is people not dying. And I think that that's a good policy choice. It's a public health approach. When people get in a car accident that they caused, we don't tell them, well, we're not going to send you to the emergency room because you caused that accident. So guess what? You're just going to have to bleed out in the middle of the street because it was your fault. You caused that accident. You didn't hit the brake on time.
Could we let users shoot up only if they go to treatment?
You can't put barricades.
Does it work like that?
It's never going to get used.
Those are scientifically, that's basically what we do now. We tell people you can go into housing if you get clean. So we erect all sorts of barriers in the system, and we recognize that we erect these barriers. And the city of Seattle last year has begun to shift how we require our service providers to actually treat people who need their services. And the reality is that we need to have a people-centered approach, and that means you take people as they come and recognize that if you are going to impose upon them that they have to be perfect before they come through your doors, then what's the point of having your doors? There's no need for your services if you're requiring them to get clean and sober before they come in. So I think from my perspective, this safe injection policy is recognizing that people are already engaging in drug abuse and addiction. Oftentimes we conflate the questions between, are we trying to, through a particular policy, prevent drug use or drug abuse? I think we had the same conversation when we were talking about legalization of marijuana. Now, I think it's really important for us to recognize that whether we like it or not, there are people out there who are abusing drugs and they are dying as a result of that. And we have ways to prevent those deaths from occurring while also giving them a pathway for when they're ready to be able to seek chemical dependency interventions and the mental health service preventions that they need, and also housing and stability that they're going to need to actually be successful in their recovery. We are not doing that. We just continue to punish people and pretend like if we tell you not to do it, you're somehow going to stop doing it.
So, Randy, this isn't people versus people. This is, I think everybody here is agreeing that we don't want people to abuse drugs or become addicted or transmit disease or die of an overdose or die prematurely. So we're really agreeing on much more than we're disagreeing on. And then it's the question is how, right? Is that fair?
I think that's fair indeed. And I just think it's whether it is there, so what brought you to, yeah. Is there a law and order approach that
yeah.
works better?
What brought you to that conclusion that the law and order approach is, given that there are already people using and being addicted, what has made you come to the position that permitting this illegal activity is going to make people suffer more?
I am at that position because Seattle is looking to become the only place in the United States that allows this.
Well,
so
there's a first
so
for
we're
everything.
Going,
but
we're going to be first because we can't figure out anything else.
I don't think it's that we can't figure out. It's that we have figured out that there is something else that we could be trying. And to be fair, the people who are involved in the law and order community also like this approach. King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg said that he believes that prior to this, in the 80s and 90s, with the crack cocaine epidemic, we assumed that the criminal justice system would handle it. And instead, he says, now we're allowing the public health community to handle it. And so that's what this is. This is public health handling instead. And it is a public health issue. Close to 20,000 needles are exchanged a day in this city. That is how you spread disease. And that's disease that spreads to all of us, right? Like, don't think that this is something that happens far away from you. Like, those kinds of diseases that spread and the things that happen when people overdose, those are huge public health risks that to assume that is 100% the result of criminal activity and not of a public health public health risk is incredibly narrow-sighted. And we've been treating it like criminal activity. And guess what? That hasn't worked. It's gotten way worse under this idea that you can law and order your way out of it. We clearly cannot. We have all the evidence. And then one other thing I would add, too, is there is a feeling that people who are addicted to heroin are bad people who live outside and are gross, icky junkies. Recall, the reason we have seen this uptick in heroin addiction is because we have seen an uptick in opioid addiction, which is medicine prescribed by doctors. And these are people who are like, these are your elderly mother who was prescribed a painkiller and then realized she could have the same thing, but cheaper, and it's heroin, right? Like, opioids are an actual gateway drug. And so when we think about who these people are who need these safe injection sites, they're not just like gross, yucky people that you don't like. The way that people get hooked on heroin, one, shouldn't matter for whether or not they get treatment. But two, it's really important to go upstream and think about like how people get there, because that's how they get there.
Anna, can you recognize that Randy has the same in saying that permitting, allowing this activity to go on under the government's protection is that he's saying he thinks that's a bad way to go because you are allowing or maybe encouraging more use than there would be otherwise? Whether you agree or not, I just want to – I feel like we're – our goals are the same, right?
But here's what I would liken it to. We do not have very good public restrooms in Seattle. As a result, we have a real issue with public urination. So you can either just tell people, hold it all day, I guess, or you could put in public restrooms and then people can use them. One of them seems like you're permitting it, but it's going to happen anyway. And the other one leaves you with problems that you don't want to have to deal with. So what I would say is people are going to do this anyway. Give them a place to do it that is safe. And here's the other thing. You're right. This would be the first in the country. We haven't tried this yet. If it all goes south, then Randy can be very smug and happy that it didn't work. If it's great and we save lives.
I would look at it and go, another waste of taxpayer money. And the public bathroom is an interesting analogy because Seattle did try to solve that by putting in public restrooms that got used as safe needle sites and prostitution sites.
So maybe we need safe injection sites.
But no, you were talking about the public restrooms, and gee, we just need to put them in. But the city of Seattle was incapable of doing that without creating problems.
City council member?
Yeah, I'll just say that, I think that We currently, the status quo is take a criminal justice approach, a law and order approach to solving the heroin epidemic. That is status quo. That's not a new policy. That is just keep doing what you're doing. And we're just going to, keep sending bodies to the morgue and filling up our jails and costing the taxpayers millions of dollars per year to continue to implement, enforce, and go down a pathway of using a tool that we know just doesn't work.
Well, it sounds like we're about to find out something about this, that Seattle and King County are expected to put these in place.
It will, but I'll say when you know that there is a solution to what is an agreed issue, you should use a successful tool and a successful policy tool to address that issue. We all agree that there's a heroin epidemic. We all agree that people are dying from the heroin epidemic. And the reality is that all of the scientific literature, all of the medical literature says that if you want to prevent deaths, that is a public health approach. And the best public health approach to take in that case is to supervise injection with on-site wraparound services to provide people the opportunity to get off of heroin and into a clean life, because they will not be able to do that alone.
City Council Member Lorena Gonzalez, we are out of time. State Republican strategist Randy Peppel, co-founder of Seattle-ish, Seattle writer Hannah Brooks Olson, thanks for reviewing the week with us.
Thank you.
We're on Twitter at KUOW. You can always get a podcast of Week in Review, The Record. You never really miss the show. Take it with you wherever you get your podcasts, including KUOW.org. This is KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, broadcasting from Bellingham, 90.3 FM. Olympia, you hear us at 1340 AM.